History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions. And then to be patient enough to listen intently as memories that may have been buried for decades return to the surface again. Our goal, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And what we always find is that in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. In our last episode, we prepared you for the 81st anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor through the memories of three Pearl Harbor survivors who were still with us all past the century mark. Wednesday, December 7th was that 81st anniversary, and that rallying cry that echoed throughout the U.S. 8 decades ago, Remember Pearl Harbor, was carried out all across our country. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find video links for official ceremonies at both the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and from Pearl Harbor, where just 6 survivors of the attack were able to make it this year for the observance. It's nearly 5,000 miles between those two pieces of hallowed ground, two spots where people gather every day to honor and remember. But Pearl Harbor was also remembered in big cities and smaller hometowns all across America this week. And let's hope it always is. I had the privilege of observing Pearl Harbor Day this year in Clovis, California, at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District with 102-year-old Frank Paredes. You heard some of his story on our last episode. And those who gathered there in Clovis on Pearl Harbor Day heard some of his memories from December 7th, and they got a big taste of his resilient spirit. As refreshments were served afterwards, some inquisitive grade schoolers quizzed Frank and Air Force veteran Bill Tokomoto, who as a 7-year-old civilian on Oahu on that day of infamy, had witnessed a dogfight between American and Japanese aircraft. Another veteran you heard on our last episode, USS Oklahoma survivor George Coburn, had quite an adventure on Pearl Harbor Day in Oceanside, California this year. The nonprofit Dream Flights took George up in a vintage Stearman biplane and gave him a bird's-eye view of his native San Diego at age 102. In many spots across the land, a single Pearl Harbor survivor, like Dick Higgins in Bend, Oregon, marked a final living link to that day of infamy. And we know it's not going to be long until all the survivors are gone. But what they've lived these last 81 years for is to make sure the rest of us never forget. Again, I have a link to video of the official remembrance at Pearl Harbor for you at hometownheroesradio.com, but here is how that ceremony began.
Unfortunately, we recognize that we could not have all the veterans with us on site, though they are not with us here, they are not forgotten. With that in mind, at this time, we would like to present a special welcome message from Lou Conter, a Pearl Harbor survivor who was stationed aboard the USS Arizona on the morning of December 7th. Lou will honor all of the veterans who could not make it to today's ceremony, but who still hold a special place in our hearts and in our thoughts.
Hello, is an audio recording. I'm Lou Conter, a Pearl Harbor survivor and World War II veteran. I am one of 2 remaining survivors from the USS Arizona. My remaining shipmate, Ken Potts, lives in Provo, Utah. I had hoped to be with you in Honolulu for this 81st commemoration, but my 101-year-old legs are not what they used to be. Back in 1941, most of us stationed at Pearl Harbor were in our teens or 20s. As quartermaster of the watch on December 7th, 1941, I remember it was beautiful Sunday morning. The Arizona band members were gathering on the ship deck to play colors at 0800. But before they could finish setting up, they heard the unmistakable whine of flying planes. The rising sun on the planes told us that this was not a drill. We manned our battle stations on the relentless strafing and bombing. But the damage to the Arizona was severe. We took a heavy bomb alongside the starboard side forward, a number two turret, and it went through five decks into the lower handling room and exploded the forward magazines, which had all the powder, a million pounds of powder for the 14-inch guns. We then started helping the men within the flames come out of the fire, helping them lay down until we could get them over the boats to get them to the hospital. I've been back for many commemorations, and each time I am on the Arizona Memorial, I take a moment to view the names of my shipmates and thank God for their ultimate sacrificing. Thank you all for attending this important commemoration in person, and those of you who are watching on a stream. Your interest in preserving World War II history is vital and important. We need to make some future generations understand what Pearl Harbor really was about and what was at stake. Our schools need to teach more than a paragraph on Pearl Harbor. I've briefed a lot of high schools and junior high schools, and they're all happy to have the truth come out and what really happened. In their history books, there's only a half a page on Pearl Harbor. They should have at least a chapter, if not more, because that's a very important part of history and for our children to teach their children and remember. Thank you to the organizers of this gathering for dedicating this commemoration to the greatest generation. That includes those who served in uniform and those who worked on the home front. The heroes are the ones that didn't come home, the ones that lost their lives, the 2,403 members of the military that lost their lives that day, including 1,177 of my shipmates on the Arizona. Thank you, my wonderful family, for being constantly supportive. One of my proudest and most commemorative was last year when I pinned my pilot's badge, which I had received in November 1942, on my great nephew, Marine Captain Ray Hauer. What an amazing 100th birthday present it was for me. Thank you all. I hope to see you all next year, getting my legs in good shape. Thank you very much, and remember Pearl Harbor.
Powerful words from one of the last two survivors of the USS Arizona, Lew Conter, heard by a crowd of roughly 2,500 at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 2022. That's a crowd whose size just about matched the number of lives lost there 81 years ago. Something else happened this week that certainly could be overlooked. In Rhode Island, on December 8th, 2022, a keel-laying ceremony for a new submarine that will carry the name USS Arizona. It featured the granddaughter of USS Arizona survivor Dawn Stratton, Nikki Stratton, welding her initials on a steel plate that will adorn that new sub. Dawn Stratton's tale of his ordeal on December 7th, 1941 is one that you can't help but be gripped by. It's told in the best-selling book All the Gallant Men, which the family hopes will someday become a feature film to help extend that Pearl Harbor legacy. And while he was still with us, Dawn also shared his story on Hometown Heroes.
How did you experience that morning? What's the first thing you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Oh, it was nothing. It was just quarter for muster, and then we had chow, and then we had colors, and whatever. So it was just a normal day for us.
So what was the first indication that it wasn't a normal day?
Well, it was just we had a little notice there, and they had the sound general quarters, and everybody was on duty. So here and there and aboard ship, my battle station was a sight setter in the port anti-aircraft guns on the port side. And that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess. But we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that told us a heaving line that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and they small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
And how did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number 2 turret went into a million pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. And that just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we were kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. 6 of us went across there.
I know you're not into getting all syrupy and sappy, but I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You try to figure out what to do. That's it.
Are you looking around? Are you watching what's happening? Are you closing your eyes and praying?
No, you're just trying to get out of the way from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heave line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and there was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burned. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did the adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach. And they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most generally figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties. But it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of a lot of patience. And
yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, that they didn't. They got a notice that I hadn't made, didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. So, but they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of skin grafts and a lot of stuff, a lot of baths, and a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us in on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went through boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff. And I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406, USS Stack, STACK. And we headed for the South Pacific right away. And we were in on the invasion, the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines, and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps and the destroyers protecting them, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pick of a patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and one time there was over 100 ships and sunk and damaged in Karamret or Wise Man Cove at that time. And then they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that and that you've told your story many times, so that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess.
Was it?
Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened. But that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said, if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live.
Did you feel that you were avenging the deaths of your shipmates?
Not really. It was just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in.
Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say a lot of things to you over the years, but I've interviewed close to 1,000 World War II veterans and many courageous, incredible men who blow me away with their stories. But just your story and what you just shared and your determination, that's really remarkable, sir.
Well, like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace.
Yeah.
And I was there.
Just hearing Don Stratton's voice again takes me back to his living room in Colorado Springs. I can picture his fingerprintless hands forever altered on that day of infamy, showing me a piece of his ship, the USS Arizona, a piece that's now on display at the National Museum of World War II Aviation in Colorado Springs. That is definitely worth a visit. Don's book, All the Gallant Men, is definitely worth the read. And speaking of USS Arizona artifacts, another piece of that battleship is the latest addition to the World War II collection at the Central Coast Veterans Museum in San Luis Obispo, California, where we've had loyal Hometown Heroes listeners for over a decade now. So if you're in that area, California's Central Coast, or visiting there, check it out. When we come back, more from the 81st anniversary ceremony at Pearl Harbor and more memories from men who survived that day of infamy. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car, and here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We prepared you for the 81st anniversary of Pearl Harbor last time, and we reflect on it this time. We'll get back to our normal format of a single veteran story next episode. One reason I try to bring you highlights from the ceremony at Pearl Harbor each year is because we get the perspective of those leading our military today on why what happened all those years ago still matters. One of the speakers at this year's commemoration at Pearl Harbor was Rear Admiral Stephen Barnett.
I offer a warm welcome to all the World War II veterans and all other military veterans, active duty and retired, as well as your families, as you join us here for this very special occasion. I also want to offer my sincerest regrets and heartfelt aloha to the Pearl Harbor survivors and the veterans of World War II who couldn't be with us right now, those members of the warrior community who we also call the greatest generation. We know you're not physically here, but be assured you're with us in our hearts, you're with us in our thoughts, and in our gratitude. Your lives, your example of honor, your examples of courage, your examples of commitment will never be forgotten and will never cease to inspire. Ladies and gentlemen, how very appropriate it is that this ceremony is conducted right here in the contemplation circle of the beautiful grounds of the Pearl Harbor National Memorial. From this vantage point, you can see much of the historic harbor right behind me. We can try to imagine what it must have been like 81 years ago to stand on the shore of Pearl Harbor as destruction rained down on the ships of the mighty Pacific Fleet, or what it must have been to be a civilian working a few miles behind me at the shipyard, and for that fact, all over the island. Make no mistake about it, they too felt the weight of the attack and did their part to defend their island and their homes. I often wonder what it was like for the soldiers, the airmen, the Marines and the sailors who fought desperately to defend the island, to defend the aircraft, the airfields at Hickam, at Wheeler, Eva, Kaneohe, Fort Island. Just a few hundred feet where I stand is the Remembrance Circle. There you'll find the names of every soul lost in that attack, both military and civilian. So, as we remember their sacrifice, we are brought to this circle right here to contemplate what it means 81 years later. Pearl Harbor holds a unique place in the American landscape as the location of the bookends of World War II. Two iconic symbols right behind me. The USS Arizona Memorial and the USS Missouri provide a powerful visual reminder of the lessons learned from the veterans who served throughout the duration of the war. They served with valor, beginning on the attack day, December 7, 1941, until victory was achieved and peace was announced on board the USS Missouri in 1945 in Tokyo Bay. We honor the courageous men and women, military and civilian, both alike, who worked tirelessly to defend our freedoms and secure the liberty that we enjoy this very day. They secured the victory and established the peace by serving in the military and serving on the civilian workforce. They were in the battlefields of faraway lands, also on the home front, from the farms of rural America to the factories, the shipyards, and supply depots of this great industrialized nation. Back in 1943, Pearl Harbor was an operationalized base. So here, right here, in the middle of the Pacific, our Navy focused on the needs of the fleet. Pearl Harbor ensured our ships and our planes had the repairs, the fuel, and other supplies needed to succeed. And we continue that very legacy right now here, 81 years later. And when that war concluded, another great legacy was born. Today, America's relationship with the people of Japan is a model of good relationships everywhere. Britain, France, Germany, once mortal enemies, in some cases over centuries, are now strong democracies, friends, and allies in Europe. Our Navy trains and operates with the Japan Self-Defense Force and other navies throughout the world, including right here in Hawaii, as you know, during the Rim of the Pacific exercise. The world, with just a few outliers, value security, value prosperity, and value stability. Histories show democracies work together to foster peace and cooperation. To the veterans watching around the country and around the world, we are inspired by your courage. We are inspired by your courage under fire. We vow to honor each and every one of you and remember your legacy well past this ceremony. We will honor you with our lives and with our service as the defenders of the values of liberty and peace that you fought to preserve 81 years ago. Your legacy will never be forgotten, and we salute you. Mahalo.
Great to get the perspective of today's military leaders on why the legacy of Pearl Harbor and America's response in World War II looms so large still today. Again, that was Rear Admiral Stephen Barnett at the official 81st anniversary commemoration on Oahu. Not far from where he shared those words, you'll find a memorial to the battleship USS Oklahoma, which lost 429 of her crew on that day of infamy. Richard Artley was a young sailor on the Oklahoma, excited to be serving on the very same ship as his brother, Darrell.
We had just come back from breakfast. We thought we had something that run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma, and very likely 10. I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over to port 151 degrees. Just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water.
And we've seen those famous pictures of the Oklahoma on December 7th. I have to ask, I haven't talked to anybody who was through what you were through on that day, to be trapped like you were. As those torpedoes are hitting, what did that feel like? What did that sound like? And did you have any idea where you were or what was going on?
Well, I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we had gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, was a heavyweight wrestler. He was a second-class quartermaster. He had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on. And one of his dumbbells, I don't know why, I could never make myself understand what the heck I was doing in the telephone booth. But I had just stepped out, and one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose.
So this is all happening on December 7th, 1941, as a nation is about to realize that it's at war. And you were realizing it before pretty much anyone else. I mean, the very first torpedoes were hitting your ship, would sink your ship, and you're trapped inside your ship as it's turning over. When did you realize that you were trapped, and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steering aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so I slept some of the time down there. And the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him, just a short time before he died, I asked him, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment went completely full of water? He said, oh, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it.
And how long were you down there?
Well, we got out about 6 p.m. Monday night.
And this happened before 8 a.m. Sunday morning.
The ship had already been hit with all those torpedoes and already turned over. And they drilled holes wherever they had to get to us. We were very fortunate. We had two seamen on there. They'd gone to quartermaster school in the States before. They had just joined the ship about 2 weeks before the war started. And they knew Morse code. Somehow they got to talking to some of these people. And they finally told him, don't talk to us anyway. We know where you are and we're coming as fast as we can. When they did get down to us, they drilled these holes. They said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. They just passed us out of the ship. And there's a Liberty boat down there, and one of the guys, George DeLong, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night, this is Monday night.
You guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
I didn't have a clue.
You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done. Oh, I was scared. We all talked very positively. They'd get to us some way. Lieutenant Commander Hobby was the ship's first lieutenant. He kept talking to us, and we got down where we could talk to him verbally. We got our spirits up then, and we thought, now he's going to really get us out of here. And by golly, they did.
When did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Daryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Daryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Daryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who didn't lose siblings in the war, but lost friends. And a lot of them felt like the life they led, that they couldn't take anything for granted. They had to stay positive and move forward, because if their friends had lived, that's what they would have done. Did you ever feel anything along those lines, feeling like you had to live in a way that would have honored your brother's sacrifice?
I tried to. Probably didn't do a very good job. I used to think about him all the time.
Richard Swede Artley, a Pearl Harbor survivor, remembering one of the victims of that surprise attack, his brother Daryl. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, one more speech from this year's commemoration at Pearl Harbor, followed by one more Pearl Harbor survivor story. And remember, the reason so many of these survivors were so dedicated about telling their stories for so long is so that you would be willing to carry that history forward. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons Citizens EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and another opportunity to reflect on Pearl Harbor after America paused this week to remember. In our nation's capital on the 81st anniversary, a group of World War II veterans from the Austin, Texas area was present at the National World War II Memorial for the commemoration there. Then they were all welcomed at the White House by President Joe Biden. Six Pearl Harbor survivors were on Oahu for the ceremony there, where the keynote speech was delivered by the director of the National Park Service, Charles Chuck Sams III.
This year's theme is Everlasting Legacy, and here at Pearl Harbor National Memorial, we hold the stories, people, and memories close to our hearts. The first-person account from those who were here on that morning 81 years ago add a power and meaning to this site in a way that no one else can. Today and always, we remember all who served, especially those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. We honor them by preserving their legacy as an inspiration for future generations. My late grandfather, Charles F. Sam Sr., answered the call to duty and served in the Pacific Theater during World War II. He was a gunner's mate on the USS Converse and served under the command of former Chief of Naval Operations Arleigh Burke. Six of my grandfather's brothers, my great uncles, all served during World War II, from North Africa to the Italian campaign to the eventual liberation of Europe. Our family stories of service led me to serve in the world's greatest Navy. Their legacy, their stories, their sacrifice were a true demonstration of what a nation can do when it's called to war. A crucial part of the National Park Service mission is to share our collective history, including the difficult and sometimes untold stories for all people, for all times. By joining us today, paying your respects, learning about the history and sharing it with others, you are now part of this everlasting legacy. I challenge you to carry the Pearl Harbor legacy forward, sharing the stories of valor and sacrifice with your friends and family, and instilling a sense of respect and inspiration in future generations, as we heard that call this morning. That's how we keep the everlasting legacy of Pearl Harbor alive and continue to honor those whose lives were lost so many years ago.
Charles Sams III, director of the National Park Service. And as he shared those words with a crowd of about 2,500 at Pearl Harbor, right across the harbor on the USS Missouri, the battleship famous for hosting the official surrender of Imperial Japan in Tokyo Bay at the end of World War II, a silent service included students from the Navy's Hale Kaiki School, a school that had grown accustomed to annual visits from Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Ganich, who passed away this past May at the age of 102. A fellow Pearl Harbor survivor named Bob Fernandez carried on that legacy for Mickey this year, and Mickey's widow, Barbara, was there with them as well. Mickey never missed an opportunity to share his December 7th story and how he was in football pads when the attack began.
We were ready to play a game. We had a game out on the ship's football team, and made the first team on. I wasn't very big. I was pretty big. I was 170 pounds there. I was big in those days. Now, if you're not 250, you're nothing there. So I joined the ship's football team, and we had a great team. And we scheduled to play USS Arizona for a fleet football championship 1 o'clock, December 7, 1941. That was going to be the Super Bowl of the Navy. It was really important there. So we was going to do a little scrimmaging, get ready for the game, and leave the ship at 8 o'clock in the morning, December 7th. There was no place to change clothes. Our little field is close by to us there, so we had all our padding on for the attack. When the attack came there, you go to your battle station. You don't have time to change clothes or anything. So up in the crow's nest, I went in my football uniform, all my padding on there, little trap door to get up there, pulled myself through to get up there. That was my battle station. I was a lookout. Whether you're in port or not there, mm-hmm. you go where your battle station is.
Well, and I want people to understand how jolting of an interruption this was. How long had you been at Pearl as part of the Pennsylvania's crew before that day?
I joined the USS Pennsylvania August 15th, 1941. Mm-hmm. So I was on the team on the ship itself for about 3 months or so before the war started.
So this is a pretty good adventure for an Ohio farm boy. I mean, yeah. You're out here in paradise. You get to play football for the Navy.
Yeah.
So that's what you did every weekend, was played somebody else in football?
Well, anybody, we beat. I think we had a 9-1 or a 10-1 record, something like that. We had a real good team, and we had a good record there to prove it.
And you played on the line?
Yeah, the running guard. I protected the quarter. I wasn't big enough to be a receiver or heavy enough to carry the ball, so they used me for running interference and protecting the quarterback. That was my job.
With a leather helmet, right?
Yes, oh yeah. Not the fancy ones like we have nowadays.
I've had a lot of guys who played in that era tell me they think it was a safer game with leather helmets than it is now.
I think it was, because it still worked good for us.
But you played right there on Oahu, not far from the docks?
Yeah. It's the same place where the Aloha Stadium is right now.
Oh, okay.
Where they played this Pro Bowl, I think, is that they played it.
Yeah.
That's where the field was, where we were going to play against Arizona.
So you'd done this before. This, you know, it's a routine Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Did you have any reason to believe there was any chance of the Japanese attacking?
Well, we'd been talking for months there whether we're getting a war or not, and we figured no one would bother us there. We got 8 battleships in port there. We're powerful. A country would be crazy to try to attack us. If there would be any problem at all, it'd be in the Philippines, so we don't have to worry about it. So what the policy was during the week there, the ships would go out to sea and maneuver around, the gunnery practice and all that, and be in port on the weekends there. The whole fleet would be in port practically. The only thing is, except for the aircraft carriers were not in port. They were taking planes. Admiral Halsey, when his aircraft carrier group were taking planes to Midway and Wake Island, so they were not in port. Fortunately, mm-hmm. because that was the reason there that they were not in port, why there was an old third attack, an attack on Pearl Harbor, because the aircraft carriers were not in port. The third attack for the aircraft carriers was number one target, then oil fields and repair facilities.
Which would have crippled
If that would have happened, we would have lost the war. We'd be talking Japanese now, because they would have took the war, because the closest oil and closest repair facilities, 2,000 miles away, it would have been a disaster there. We were very fortunate, but bad weather had slowed the aircraft carriers up, and they were not in port. If it had been good weather, they'd been in port, we'd have been attacked. We'd have lost the war. It's that simple.
So let's talk about how the farm boy from Ohio experienced this. You just turned 22 a few weeks before that.
Yeah.
So you're in your football pads getting ready for a scrimmage before the big game with the Arizona at 1. And what was your first indication that the Japanese were there?
Well, the living compartment of the in fact, to be a quartermaster, let me tell you how I became a quartermaster. They asked me what I'd like to do. I got good grades. I took my education seriously. I got good grades in my tests, and they said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'm not mechanically minded. I'd like to do something there that would not require mechanical aptitude there. They said, how you like to steer a ship? I said, that's great for me, because back there in Ohio, the biggest thing we saw at Lake Erie was ferry boats there. And I said, oh, they said, Yeah, how'd you like to steer a ship inside of the harbor, outside the harbor, out at sea? I said, that's for me. So they made me a quartermaster. So I went to quartermaster and signal school in San Diego. And then when I got on the ship there, one of the main duties there was steering the ship. And I ended up steering that 33,000-ton battleship in and out of the harbors there, all over the Pacific, it seemed like there. That's pretty good for a farm boy. And I never even saw anything bigger than a ferry boat up close. Mm-hmm. And then steer that 608 feet long, 33,000-ton battleship. I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't steer it on December 7th, though, because it was in dry dock.
That's right. We had a propeller tow. Fortunately, normally when we were in port, we would tie up at a dock, 10-10 mm-hmm. dock. That's how long that dock is, 1010 feet long. We always had an admiral aboard when we went out at sea because we were the flagship of the fleet. Mm-hmm. Whenever we came in port, we tied up at the dock there. But a couple of days before that, we had a propeller tow. They put us in dry dock with two other destroyers casting in the downs, saying we weren't in our normal place there. The ships have moved into the place where we normally did be. I torpedoed Ogallala in the hell and I got hit. They were the place where we would be because I found out later two Japanese airplanes were scheduled to hit the USS Pennsylvania. They wanted to make sure they knock out the flagship of the fleet because, you know, in your Indian movies, you knock out the chief, you got a better chance to win the war. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that the Pennsylvania was hit. Well, the Ogallala was sunk, the Helena was damaged there, but they were aiming for us. Well, we weren't in our normal place, fortunately.
So for you, you started to tell me where the living quarters were and what your first alarm to this situation was.
We're going
to
leave the ship at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes to get from the living compartment to the quartermaster's to get up on deck, so we leave the ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to 8, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang. Called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it, because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there was no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, all hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, which you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the closeness, that's where I had to go. So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there, looked close enough, you hit them with rocks, if you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout, that was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going in, you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A little trap door to get through there, pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. Armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm on the course, as it came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So but if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck and you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
Oh, it really shook me, but we didn't know where it hit because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there. But it came on past me, and I saw the result of it, but I didn't see it happening.
And this whole time, because of your elevated position,
you're seeing a whole lot of other things.
Yeah. In fact, my job was to look how to report anything of interest there I could report, or what it is of phones on the ship itself. It's sound-powered phones is what it is. I would see the plane coming over the top of the buildings, because the building's fairly close to us, too. I saw this plane coming over the top of the buildings. I reported to it there. They turned their guns around, facing that direction. When he came past his building, pow, we got him. That's the only plane we knocked down there. If they had trained the guns around to get the plane, they'd never had it, but they had the guns trained in that direction. So when the plane come over that way, they got him. They were ready for him.
And
so
you gave him a good scouting report.
Yeah. So that made me feel pretty good. I did accomplish something.
Well, and if you hadn't, that plane might have done something to your ship, too.
That's right.
You know, you hear a lot about D-Day as the longest day, but I'm wondering how long December 7th, 1941 felt for you.
It felt pretty long there, but we're just glad, because in between there was about a 10-15 minute gap in between the first attack and second attack. So I had a chance to look around and get below and change clothes, get out of my football uniform on and get in my regular clothes. And then you didn't really have time to think about it. But I saw the results there. I saw the hole alongside me where the bomb came. Saw machine gun nicks in the ladder where I climbed up to get up to the crow's nest. Whether it happened before I went up there, after I went up there, or during the time I went up, I don't know, but they didn't get me. That's kind of scary, too.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't see what could have happened there, but I figured God had other plans for me. He's looking out for me.
We are all so, so thankful he did. I had the privilege of speaking at Mickey Gannich's memorial service aboard the USS Hornet Museum a few months back, and afterwards, his wife Barbara did the kindest thing. She sent me some of Mickey's ties. I wore one of Mickey's ties on this 81st anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and there may be more to that particular tie's story in the future, but as we wrap up this episode of Hometown Heroes, I want to share the conclusion of that ceremony at Pearl Harbor this year. Before a 21-gun salute and the playing of taps, it was the Navy's Chief of Chaplains, Rear Admiral Gregory Todd, delivering the benediction.
Eternal Father, in whose hands rest the souls of your people, living and dead, we are grateful for your presence with us here today as we considered the sacrifice of shipmates 81 years ago. For those who grieve their losses from that day, we pray for your comfort to relieve their burden. For those of us who follow in the tradition of naval service, grant us faithful hearts that we may remain true to our calling to defend our homeland, to advance the cause of freedom, and to honor our friendships with allies. Grant us also the courage to be faithful to those with whom we serve today. Lord, we think of for our shipmates in need. Let us bring a willingness to help. For shipmates facing challenges, let us bring your strength of spirit. For shipmates feeling alone, let us bring the assurance that we stand together. And finally, O Lord, we pray for our leaders, that you may grant them wisdom. For our shipmates who are underway, standing the watch, or in harm's way, that they may rest in your protection and have a joyful reunion with loved ones. And for ourselves, all of us here, that by faith in you and your strength, we may be spiritually ready to live lives of honor, courage, and commitment, that we may reflect your love. Amen.
There isn't much more for me to say other than thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, encouraging you to remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert, and never forget that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.